Hello and welcome everyone back to another episode of The Publisher Lab. I'm Tyler Bishop, joined alongside me, Whitney Wright. Whitney, we were just talking about the podcast getting a little bit of an upgrade.
I know, yeah. As we've said before in other podcasts, if you leave comments on our YouTube channel or on our publisherlab.org page, we do look at them and listen to you. So one of the suggestions was, as you'll see in this video, and when it's focused on me, Tyler will still be up in the corner, so and vice versa. So that was someone left a comment about that, and we thought it was a really cool addition. So we've added it. So if you have something to say, don't feel afraid to say something because we definitely look at those.
Yeah, and I know, I mean, like as a publisher, there's like rare things that like ours guiding is basically your users telling you what they want or something they think would be cool. I know whenever I would like run or operate sites, like the things that were always the most helpful to me or whenever somebody actually did reach out or somebody got in contact with me on a forum or something and would say like, oh, I love the jiu-jitsu like stat articles that you put out or something like that. Because what I would always tell people, and it's still this way today whenever I make content, if I get that feedback from somebody that's very positive but also constructive, it's like that's really guiding in that, like to me that always is representative of probably a lot more people and I try to lean into it. And so, yeah, as a publisher, I think everybody that watches and listens to our show can probably relate to that.
Yeah, they're probably watching multiple podcasts or listening to multiple podcasts, and they probably picked up on stuff that is helpful or beneficial or even just, you know, more fun to see both of us at the same time. So yeah, this fun is one of those.
Or maybe it's for people that like leave this on for their dogs or cats whenever they leave the house. I always do wonder about that. There's got to be a fair amount of that going on.
Yeah, definitely. I should leave this on for my cat.
I think that's my theory on why the Price is Right is still on.
It's because they leave it on for their animals.
Yeah, primarily.
Well, we have some good topics today. Just to kind of run through them real quickly, we have the end of the Google March 2023 broad core update. It's done rolling out, so we'll cover a little bit of that. Although, you know, it is always hard to know exactly what happened during the updates. We've talked about that before. We're talking about how AI-powered Bing is making inroads on Google search leads. So, which I know it's not big, but it is, you know, causing a little bit of some like fluctuation in that. And then Elon Musk and others urge AI to pause, citing risks to society. So we got some good topics. Some of them are about AI, but we're going to start with the Google March 2023 broad core update. This is from Search Engine Roundtable. So it finished rolling out yesterday, March 28th. It kicked off about 2 weeks ago, March 15th. They saw that the biggest volatility was on March 16th and then another one around 23rd, 24th. It's a little bit more volatile than the September 2022 update, but it's mostly the same. And when they looked at the top 3, 5, and 10 positions, data showed the March 2023 update showed lower rank volatility than the September 2022 in the top 5 positions. So really not a ton of volatility there. The main takeaways...
And it's a pretty small sample, right?
Like, it is, yeah. The main takeaways that SEO experts have kind of gathered together is that it looked at all types of content. It's not a penalty update. It's rewards great web pages. It's a global update, affects all regions and languages. It seems to be a typical core update that reaches wide and impacts fast. And it did affect Google Discover feature snippets and kind of more little things like that.
I actually think that if Google just didn't tell people they did updates anymore, no one would act. Like,
I know.
There would still be guesses and things like that. But I think most of the time people would be wrong because most of the chatter that I see around like shifts in people's traffic, it's sort of inferred, meaning like, we're natural. This is how humans behave when it relates to data. But somebody you tell them there's an update. Yeah, my traffic's down like 20%. Well, maybe it's just down that day 20%, right. You know, or that week. Or maybe it was down one day 20%. And then the rest of that week, it was down a little bit. But maybe that's seasonal. But for you, you look at that with the algorithm update and you're like, oh, okay. So like I was definitely impacted. Mm-hmm. So then in a month, you're like, oh, they must have rolled it back. So now I got my traffic back.
Right.
But that's a really common experience because anybody that had like lower week over week traffic normally looks at that and thinks that they were quote unquote penalized. What I think we mentioned on the last one, which is like when we zoom out like more than a couple months, you know, like there's almost no change or shift. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I actually have pulled this data as early as last night because we're building this It's like a heat map basically showing like who has benefited over time from Google search results. And the thing that's amazing is there's only one update that's occurred in the last 5 years in which more publishers didn't get more traffic from Google.
Really?
Yeah. So what you see is you see basically the top sites like, CNN or something like that, brand publishers start getting less traffic. They start to get cannibalized a little bit by smaller and smaller, more like niched out sites. And over time, what you see is even those smaller sites, like they'll start to get more width in certain verticals versus, you know, like the other ones. But it basically is like in Google's best interest to always be able to distribute the traffic among as many parties as possible, because it creates an incentive and a market in which you don't have anybody that has significant negotiation power against you.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And we did cover this kind of the other week, but I knew publishers would probably be wanting to know what's going on with the update after it finishes. And so, yeah, like we said, look at your data over a longer period of time to see how much you've been affected. And you probably haven't been affected that much, if anything. And it's going to kind of work itself out.
The biggest thing that I would tell publishers whenever you really want to evaluate this is number one, get into Search Console. Mm-hmm. It's so much better than Google Analytics. Like, your Google Analytics could be a billion things because all it's doing is tracking what's happening on the page. You can mess that up. WordPress, another plugin, can mess that up. Bots can mess that up. Your host, it just goes on and on. But Search Console is Google's data. So basically get into Search Console, get into your pages, and then look at just the pages. So you can do that by clicking on just the little, they have the orange box or the orange, blue, green, something boxes up at the top. If you click on basically either impressions or clicks, your choice. Clicks is probably better because it's the people that actually came to your site. And look at page or queries and then compare like whatever the time period from the update till now to the previous period. And you should be able to see like, is it your whole site? Is it all your keywords? Or is it, because it shows the difference like by ranking spot, by number of clicks, by number of times it showed up in search results. Like, typically what I find is that if it's truly an algorithm update and all your traffic isn't already consolidated into one page, which does happen, you'll be able to find out pretty quickly, was it just like one page that quote unquote got hit? Like I remember one time there was an update around Valentine's Day and the publisher lost some traffic, but when we looked at it, we found out that it was gifts for boyfriend, gifts for girlfriend, or something like that as the keyword. And, you know, it was right after Valentine's Day. So it just so happens that that page was getting less traffic, and that, you know, like that kind of little insight kind of calms your fears a little bit, because you're like, okay, all the traffic that I lost, I know what that's from.
Right. It makes sense that it would, that it went down. So yeah, look at Google Search Console and don't worry about the updates. It says, you know, great web pages, it rewards great web pages. So as long as you have good content and, you know, a good website, you're going to be fine. So the next topic we have, AI-powered Bing is making inroads on Google Search Lead. So this is a lot of data that I'm going to kind of go over really quickly. SimilarWeb shows that OpenAI integration into Microsoft Bing led to increased traffic and page views by 15.8%, and Google had a 1% drop.
Ooh.
I know, which doesn't sound like a lot, but you know, when you consider Microsoft has the opportunity to gain around $120 billion plus in the search market, it makes a big difference.
Yeah, I like how you like integrated that stat into my response as if like it wasn't just more the numbers, but I like how you're doing the numbers thing. Good job.
Yeah. Oh, good.
No, but I was going to say, like, actually, you probably have some of these here. I should let you read them because I keep seeing the same. I keep seeing charts.
Yeah.
Information that's released that shows that Bing is growing in popularity.
Yeah, there's some a little bit more information on that. So Data AI shows an 8x increase in global Bing app downloads after Chatbot edition.
What I was looking at.
Yeah, and Google Search app downloads decreased by 2%. And Bing historically has had less than a tenth of Google's market share. So winning the 1 to 2% points can be significantly detrimental to Google, actually. And so posts referring to Bing on social media networks is up 48% year over year, while Google and search on those platforms have decreased 71% month over month compared to last year. Mm-hmm. So Microsoft is increasing in popularity. And so just to kind of get a comparison, prior to the day The new Bing went live, which was February 7th. It held just 1.22% organic search traffic. And as of March 23rd, it now holds 2.6% market share, while Google declined at 1.5%. So it's super interesting. Microsoft's coming, you know, back around, making an impact.
You know, I know some of the people that work on the team there, and like, I can only imagine.
At Microsoft or Google?
At Microsoft.
Okay.
Well, yeah. Both, actually, okay, funny yeah. enough. Very different. Very different.
Yeah.
But the thing that I find really interesting about it is that team must feel like vindicated in a lot of ways, but uh-huh. for the longest time at Microsoft, they weren't really viewed as critical mm-hmm. and they kind of knew that. They yep. sort of knew like, hey, this is a multi-billion-dollar product that we support and we're going to do our best job. And, you know, like the people in that building were adamant that they felt like they had built a better product, but
yep.
you know, it's Google, you know, it's like
right.
What we think of as an incumbent sort of like non-disruptible party, like. It almost seems like silly if somebody was like, I'm going to build a search engine. You're like, okay, for what?
Right. Yeah.
You know, my wife yesterday said to me, she goes, I was looking for this thing the other day and I Googled it on Amazon. It's like
using it as a verb.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you think about how hard that would be to disrupt, yet it's very imaginable. Like I thought of a better example the other day when I was talking to somebody about this, because one of the things that we were looking at was a chart, and it showed basically like the proliferation, the growth, and the dominance of the Microsoft Office suite. Mm-hmm. So Microsoft Word, you know, mm-hmm. You worked at a company, you used a word processor, you used Microsoft Word yeah. like for the longest time. And I remember whenever I was at Microsoft, one of the things that like was that was so like driven down people's throats because it was their biggest concern at the time was Google Docs and Google's mm-hmm. workspace, like the Google suite, basically. Like, if you think about it now, it's like, I mean, we internally use it. I know mm-hmm. a lot of companies still use Microsoft, but it's competitive, right?
It is,
like,
yeah.
you choose as a business, are you gonna go Google Workspace or are you gonna go Microsoft? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's these same two companies. And I mean, I wouldn't have thought this maybe even a month ago, but I can definitely see, you know, maybe Bing being a lot more competitive in the years ahead. But you know my thoughts, audience, as well, if you listen mm-hmm. to the podcast. I think search engines and AI are different things. They can mm-hmm. aid and help each other. But, you know, we're not going to replace search engines with a chatbot. Mm-hmm. Like, AI is a different thing.
Yeah, they have completely different functions and purposes. What do you think about, like, Google kind of, they've released Bard, but there was some, I didn't cover it in this podcast, but there's some articles that I was looking at that said that Bing is better than Bard.
That is the crux of this. And so this is how I formed sort of that opinion to where I could see them being competitive, is that OpenAI's ChatGPT and all the different models that are like within it are exponentially better than Bard in terms mm-hmm. of what the user is getting. So like on the back end, Google, like I know this is the case with OpenAI, where the natural language and its ability to communicate with a human is one of the things that makes it so special mm-hmm. because the underlying model that it is able to get and retrieve data from isn't that much better than it was like a year ago, 2 years ago. And this seems to be where Bard really sucks too, mm-hmm. where it's being able to understand the intention and meaning and reasoning of a question. Like, who was I talking to yesterday? Maybe it was our colleague, Sarah. Mm. But she had mentioned that she's like, whenever I ask ChatGPT questions, I still say, please. She's like, but, you know, you think about it, it's like it's a machine waiting an input, and the input that it gets has this like passive sort of like, you know, like almost like subtlety to mm-hmm. it that you have to parse through. I mean, it's hard to communicate with humans.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it is.
And so I think that's where Bard really sucks. I played with it, had access to it, mm-hmm. and dang, Google, you had 10 years, you said you
wanted. You had it in your hands and you fumbled the ball.
And they talked this thing up so big. Internally, they would even say, you know, in the future, we're not an ad company, we're an AI company.
Yeah. Do you think they just sat on it too long and didn't get it out there, and then Microsoft kind of swooped in? And
I think they procrastinated a lot. Mm-hmm. I think that they thought they could get it just perfect. Mm-hmm. And I think that they also thought that everybody would wait on them that right. see what Google did. I think you watched everybody sort of try with these like Siri, like Cortana, Alexa, all these like assistants and stuff. But, you know, I think it's funny. It might have been, was it you or it might have been our colleague Sarah again, had said something the other day that I thought was really smart, which was.
I hope it was me.
You take credit either way.
Yeah.
We don't need to throw that much shine Sarah's way. You guys don't even know who Sarah is, audience. but whoever it was, probably you, said, you know, we had Siri and we had Alexa and we had all these like things on our phone for the last 5 or 6 years, and they're not that much better than they were 6 years ago. But in the last 3 months, we've gotten this amazing AI that can like run circles around it, is far more helpful and useful. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is sort of like maybe cuts Google a break a little bit, because it's sort of like, you know, everybody was kind of at that same point. Big tech had invested a lot of money in this, and maybe it was just the direction. They all we have to have voice assistants.
Yeah.
You know, like that wasn't the breakthrough.
No, and it was Sarah. I saw it in Slack today. Ah. I know, but I'd love to take credit for it, but I have to give credit where credit is due. That's totally accurate. And so do you think that Google has the ability or opportunity to kind of swoop back in and surpass them to like become the dominant? I mean, they still are dominant, but, you know, in this at least regard.
Yeah. So I listened to a podcast with Sam Altman, OpenAI's CEO. And one of the things that he had mentioned, because they asked him, like, how do you plan to keep from being disrupted if you see this as a fast accelerating space? And he says, well, we can't. We can only do the best that we can do, and we can live by our principles. But I think that the way that this will work is that there will be a lot of models and engines and platforms that provide all sorts of AI, and there won't just be one. And, you know, like his comment was basically that he had hoped that the very nature of it would lead to a situation where you wouldn't have it consolidated to just one party. And so where I see that kind of breaking out is if I could see Google improving Bard and it being as good as OpenAI's models. In fact, I mean, if OpenAI does open source, like there's stuff, there's no reason it shouldn't be.
Right.
But realistically, I think the better like route for both of them is to like carve out their own sort of paths rather than try to follow each other.
Yeah.
But if I know big tech, they're gonna very specifically compete.
Yeah, they're always like looking at each other's tests, like, you know, see who's answering
it's,
what.
It's sort of the prisoner's dilemma a little bit, where it's like Google is like, if I go this way and you go that way, if I mean, like with the voice assistants, it's like it wasn't the one, but they all went that direction, right? So as long as they all go that direction, they'll under deliver or under like achieve together versus like if one goes a different way and the other three go, you know, that way. If you're the one that went the opposite way, it's like you're dead.
Yeah.
And if you're one of the other three, it's like, okay, well, we at least one of us is gone, get to live.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like if you decide that, you know, you're going to go the opposite way and you win, like that's great, but you also have this overlying risk. And so I do think that there is a certain amount of that, like we'll all fail or succeed together.
Yeah.
Rather than the existential threat of sort of like,
do you go your own way and like have that risk? Yeah.
Classic prisoner's dilemma.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see. We're still talking about AI in the next topic, but it's,
I read this last night, actually. I hadn't read this until yesterday.
Yeah, on Reuters. So we'll just get right into it. Elon Musk and others urge AI to pause, citing risk to society. So Elon Musk and a group of artificial intelligence and industry experts are calling for this half a year pause in developing systems that are more powerful than current OpenAI's GPT-4, which they just released, I think, like last week or the week before. Yeah. So the letter was issued by the nonprofit Future of Life Institute, which is highly funded by Elon Musk's foundation. And it was signed by more than 1,000 people. And it is a pause until there's more shared safety protocols that are developed and then implemented. And the letter said, powerful AI systems should be developed only once we are confident that their effects will be positive and their risks will be manageable. So critics of the letter say it's feeding into this like AI hype and like distress and the AI harm has been greatly exaggerated. So rather than pause search, AI researchers, this is from Joanna Bjorklund. She's an associate professor at, I'm going to try to say this, Umeå University.
nice job. Nice work.
She said that rather than pause research, AI researchers should have greater transparency requirements and, you know, still continued development. So, yeah.
I think it's interesting because I've heard this a lot, like this transparency conversation. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I finally understand sort of what it means now that I've been exploring some of the different ways that you can implement machine learning. Mm-hmm. And being able to sort of see like how I finally get a description that a friend that you and I had that actually used to work with, Dr. Greg.
Mm, yes.
So I remember a long time ago him saying that machines learn like how neurons learn, mm-hmm. where it's like a neuron and maybe a dendrite or whatever, the little things that stick out of the neurons. Mm-hmm. He's like, you basically, it charges and then it connects to something the first time you do it. And the more times that you sort of do that, the more and the tighter that connection sort of gets.
Right.
And so machines over time start to do that.
Path of least resistance. Yeah.
And it's all just basically like ones and zeros and numbers, mm-hmm. where it's like, it's storing this in a way that's not like, it's not in a spreadsheet, it's not in a table. Mm-hmm. So if a machine makes a decision or learns something and then you get an output, you only know what happens. Like, mm-hmm. you don't know why necessarily it made that choice. There's not a receipt you can read.
Right.
And so regardless of, you know, like the transparency, what people are asking for is not actually what I think people mean. What mm-hmm. they want is the same thing that's impossible to have with a human, which is like, it's why we have a justice system, to be honest.
Right,
it's like,
yeah.
Why did you commit this crime?
Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah. That's the difference between like a manslaughter charge and a murder charge sometimes, right. which is like, was it intentional?
Right.
And it's like, you have to assess the motivations right. of the person, and that's impossible for a human. So I don't know why we think we'll be able to do it with a machine that's trying to basically mimic the sort of behaviors and processes that a human has.
Right. You've mentioned this before, just as a side note, like, you know, maybe in the future we're going to have laws specifically for robots.
Absolutely. AI will absolutely need its own sort of like, legal system.
Yeah. Which I think is kind of what they're getting at here. They're like, we need to slow down and kind of make rules here. And I know that the EU police force, Europol, they voiced concerns on Monday about the potential misuse and phishing attempt, disinformation, and cybercrime. And the UK government recently unveiled proposals for an adaptable regulatory framework concerning AI. So there's already kind of some things in motion. And of course, I feel like it's not surprising that the EU and the UK are kind of jumping on this, just with, you know, GDPR and stuff. They kind of were at the forefront of that before we had the California one. I don't know. What do you think about like stopping like or pausing AI for a little bit?
It's more like press attention than I can imagine anything, because obviously, I mean, it's a classic case of like, you can't put what, I forget all the different like sayings that go, but it's like, you can't put the cat back in the bag. It's like, it's out. Like you're
right.
You can't unspill whatever it is that people spill. And I do think that the area of most immediate need, this is a solvable problem. I think mm-hmm. people immediately extrapolate out to like a Terminator situation.
Yeah.
Right. I'm far less concerned about a Terminator situation. I think that we put too much value, I think, in how we view intelligence. Mm-hmm. And the overall span of like whatever existence is, mm-hmm. And that like we sort of place importance on it from the standpoint of like, we think that because of our consciousness and our ability to reason and sort of like become a dominant species on this planet, that we somehow that is like a core important function that's novel and unique in a way that's like meaningful. But realistically, like, why is that more meaningful than the fact that like some trees live 800 years? Like if I'm a tree and I could reason and think, I would be like, well, humans don't live very long. Like, are there other life on other planets that can have the longevity of a tree? We'll never know. We're trees.
Yeah.
It's a bad example because I give a
you're historically a tree the ability to reason. Always say you're bad examples, but
yeah, I'm terrible at examples. That one included. But for those that are still listening, The thing that I do think about with this is cybersecurity is going to be a huge, huge risk.
Yeah.
We are months away from almost anybody being able to probably deep fake their voice and, visual likeness on a phone. And so imagine my wife gets a phone call and it sounds like this and it says, "Hey, honey, I'm on the phone with the bank. What's your social security number again?"
Yeah.
And then boom, she spits it off to me.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
And
it's like that Pope picture with the puffy jacket. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
They like AI'd it and everybody's like, "Oh, it's puffy jacket." They're like, "This is AI." Like,
yeah. I mean, the visual images that it can generate now that are just so real to life. And, you know, like you think about not even just the high tech sort of hacking that occurs, it's the low tech stuff, like the ability to generate like fake IDs.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I didn't even think about that.
Right.
Yeah.
So like you want a fake passport. Like I know that there's like electronics and chips and, but the second that something that's proprietary that we use as a distinguishment or like a truth from like falsehood, whether it's a document or an encryption key or whatever, these things are not going to be fail safe against AI that can process and run all kinds of different mathematical problems and situations that something to solve it. This is our biggest short-term risk, and it's solvable, but not, there's no one solution. It's every industry, every person is going to have like incremental different processes for handling all the different types of fraud. And it's like all types of, you know, challenges that relates to security is it's like, you're always going to be one step behind, unfortunately.
Yeah. Cause there's always someone that's trying to get past the line. So how do you think that this could affect publishers?
So I think it affects publishers from the standpoint of, not only like site security, obviously your site being hacked and things like that, you're going to have to be aware of all the new sort of like nuanced ways.
Yeah.
But I think the ways that it could really help publishers and then also like really help like visitors and create opportunities is Web3 for all the, I think people are really down on it right now and just like, oh, well that's gone. That's not happening. But one of the novel things about it that was unique, a lot of things I didn't like about sort of Web3 and cryptocurrency was all the sort of like use cases, you didn't really need the blockchain to do them. And then in the use case that they had, you didn't really see a lot of adoption, AI being the exact opposite of that. Like people can't find enough things for it to do. But it's the wallet, that sort of mobile wallet where your device, the one that you held in your hand, was unique. And I think that there's multiple ways that you can at least box out some different forms of AI and even like hardwire fraud, meaning like I'd steal your phone or something like that, so that that can be a single source of sort of like, this is my verification. So what's nice about that is if it is device side, you don't have two factor, you don't have like, give me your email, you have basically like this direct connection. So you have a wallet permissions, which people could just hit websites. And if you've ever gone to a website that accepts a mobile wallet, you literally just press like connect. And then it's like, you want to connect? You're like, yep.
Yep.
And you're logged in. It's like almost too easy.
I know. Yeah. I think that as AI develops, we're going to see more of this, more people pushing back on it. And maybe potentially some like laws put in place.
What I would do if I was a publisher, is if I do any sort of login or user data capture, I would start adding options when I could, meaning there's a lot of new protocols that are out there that are designed to be more secure, that are just way easier. They're not adapted everywhere. So it's like, maybe I can log into Cloudflare and maybe I can log into like my cell phone service provider with, I can't remember all the names of them, but like NetSecureX or something like that, where it just allows users that have the app on their phone to just like one click log into sites that accept it. I would be very non-discerning and just offer as many options as I could without sort of like bogging down my site. But some of those will start to grow in prominence here very quickly, I think. And I think having those in place, it sort of like endears you to your users, makes things easier for them. But it also, what's funny is that, you know, the Google sign in or like Google sign up or something like that. There's so many stats that show you that having that versus requiring somebody to create an account increases the number of people that like actually sign up or like create an account by.
I love when there's a Google sign in.
Me too. And so you think about it, it's like you just increase your odds on any kind of conversion that you've got there. So that would be one area where it's like, I think this would be something to go with.
Agreed. Well, was there anything else about the topics that you had to kind of throw out there?
No, I mean, I think what we're seeing is a space that's evolving really quickly. Like I mm-hmm. said, I think we're reaching a point here really soon where the number of, I think they said that 200 new software technology products were released last week alone.
Oh my gosh.
From that included AI in them.
Yeah.
And I was like going through the list and there's so many use cases for it. Mm-hmm. And so if you're a publisher, you know, there's no end of like tools that are out there and you might go, well, what tools, what do I do with them? Run a search, look for the most recent tools that have been released. Mm-hmm. And then from there, go look at some of them, just play with them. Because I find that every time that I kind of start exploring, I like see a tool and I'm like, oh, you know what you could do with this? Or, oh, you know what would be a cool idea for this mm-hmm. would be, or now I could finally do X, Y, or Z. And I've never done that before because it would have taken too long.
Right.
Like you can get ChatGPT into Sheets through like Google Workspace extension and like
have it do equations and stuff for
you. Yeah, it's like, you know, I'm not a great pivot table maker. If you want somebody to make you a pivot table in Excel, if you want me to waste like 3 or 4 hours like getting it right, I'm your guy. But now it's like I can just have it create a pivot table for me.
Yeah.
And it's in my sheet. So, you know, I think a lot of people think of ChatGPT as this chat bot that you interact with and then it gives you the answers, then you go try to do it. I think the real secret here is you want to find all the ways you can of bringing it into your environment mm-hmm. so that it has the context of what you're working on. So you don't have to be like, I'm in a sheet and I currently have column A that's like this.
Right.
And, you know, you just be like, hey, make column A and column B a pivot table.
Yeah.
If that's how pivot table works.
don't ask me because I literally don't know. But yeah, I totally agree. there was another article I was looking. I just saw the headline and it was like, the year of mobile has dragged out for years now, but the AI surge, like it's real, it's happening right now and it's going to continue to happen. So, you know, jump on board.
It's the Gartner hype cycle. You know, I the thing that I haven't figured out yet is if it's the Gartner hype cycle, are we at the slope of enlightenment or are we at the peak of inflated expectations? And I would say we're probably closer to the trough of, or the slope of enlightenment, which is like the last stage.
Okay.
We probably just went through the trough of disillusionment, which is like the hype cycle goes where something is like, you first hear about it, it's in the zeitgeist, then you reach the peak of inflated expectations, which is it's going to solve all the world problems. Mm-hmm. Like everybody's hype on it. And then the trough of disillusionment is like, nobody is, it's not here yet. Like it's not caught on, it's dead. Yeah. And then the slope of enlightenment is whenever it actually starts gaining market share and becoming a part of everyday lives.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree with that. Well, thank you for watching the Publisher Lab or listening to the Publisher Lab. We are on YouTube. You can find us on our YouTube channel. You can find us at publisherlab.org. We have the episodes up on there. Like we said before, leave us a comment on YouTube. Give us a like, a subscribe, give us a rating on wherever you listen to podcasts.
Ask questions. I love the questions. Yeah. And the feedback is great. Like, hopefully you guys have noticed every time we get
covered
feedback.
The cement, whoever was concerned about that.
Literally, if there's things about the show that we can do to make better, I think that's a core thing, being a publisher, is being able to listen to your audience. So thank you very much for those that have provided. And then hopefully we'll hear from some of you soon.
All right. Yeah. And this has been another episode of the Publisher Lab.